or in a nice place, so it's out of the way. Because when winter comes, the soil becomes very slippery, mm-hmm. and we don't want to trip over and fall and hurt ourselves.
Yeah.
And if we don't remove anything in winter, we will have snow again, mm-hmm. and suddenly you are going to visit your garden and you can't poke yourself.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's not just ourselves, but we invite people to the garden because we are very proud of our gardens, mm-hmm. and people get injured. So just to prevent that somebody gets injured, let's clean the garden. And as well, it's to prevent that things get rotten, particularly wooden trellises, they tend to get rotten with this mm-hmm. time of year. Once we have our garden clean, as well as a good opportunity to survey the garden and have a look what is happening in there, where the water is collecting, which gives a good indication what I can plant next year, because that is the lower part of my mm-hmm. garden, water is collecting in there, and what I should not be planting during this fall or winter in there too. So it gives a good idea why the water is accumulating. Nothing is perhaps is collecting too much water mm-hmm. from somewhere. Try to look, find the source of that water. And make everything ready for when you collect leaves, mm-hmm. be able to mulch your garden too. If you are gardening in a terrace, in a patio, as well, it's important to see how the water is running. Is this really draining?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we is standing over the winter, we will have an ice sheet in there.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't realize, and then we go outside to the garden and it's all slippery. Mm-hmm. It's because just the water is standing. So it's a good time as well to see how the drainage from the patio, from our terrace, is working.
So when you get to this point in the summer, you're talking, or not summer, but into the fall.
Into the fall, yeah.
You were mentioning how, our tomato plants are pretty much done now. Do you typically recommend, cutting down the plant and or do we leave it in place?
I recommend cutting the plant.
Yeah.
So leaving the roots into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good, because there is lots of bacteria, of invertebrates and fungi still attached to the root system. So we just, above the ground, we just trim, leaving the roots in there, which is as well a physical holding of the soil during this time of the year. Then the plants that we are going to put are lettuces, arugulas, which are very shallow roots, so it won't be any damage mm-hmm. for the new winter crops. But yes, it's time to collect all the green tomatoes that have a decent size and bring them inside. They will ripen indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And all those tomatoes, they are so tiny, small, just no point to waste time collecting because they are immature and they won't ripen. So just collect all that material. And now, shall you put in the compost or shall we put in another scrap pile? So from my experience, every time that I collect my plant
mm-hmm.
and I have put it in the compost, the next year when I use in that compost, I have lots of tomato plants volunteers because the seeds haven't died during the composting period.
Yeah.
So I harvest in my compost and I'm bringing all these tomatoes.
Yeah.
So if we do that, if you put your plants into the composter, should be aware that next spring when you take the compost, you will have lots of tomato plants volunteering in your garden.
Right. So even though you've taken all the tomatoes themselves off, you're still very likely to get some seeds along with that.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, right.
And as we talked about last week, you really don't want seeds in your compost because it's going to, as you say, lots of volunteers coming up where you don't want them when you're trying to keep your garden nicely planned and organized, and all of a sudden it's lots of other stuff coming up.
Yes, yeah, so that's with the composter. So, and this time of the year, I'm noticing our composter, all our earthworms, a new population, a new generation of earthworms are mm-hmm. are growing in the composter. So it's great. So the temperature has dropped, and suddenly the worms are becoming very active in the composter.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. Like you said before, being a good janitor is an important for your garden is an important part of the whole gardening cycle.
Yes. Since that, at the moment we have just few weeks, I think we are week 39,
yeah,
and so we have 6 weeks left before the the cold weather arrives in here. So yeah, it's very short now. Now it's just time to start cleaning and tidying your garden. And once the leaves, there are some leaves in here in campus, tree leaves that are already falling. Yep. So as we can start collecting and adding to our garden bed.
Excellent. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you for having me and nice chatting.
Tell us a bit about how people can find out more about Embark Sustainability.
Yeah, so Embark Sustainability is based here in Burnaby SFU campus. We have a office in the Student Union building. Yep. And you can find information about us in our website, embarksustainability.org, or through our social media channels, hashtag EmbarkSustain.
Great. Thank you, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. Pablo is Embark's gardening manager, and don't forget to check out their website for the various programs they run. Some of them are ongoing now, so you might need to wait till January, but lots of stuff happening at Embark, right. And you can find out more at their website. Thanks for joining me today, Pablo.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.
As a child, I dreamt through each night. When would I find my home? It's been some time now, and still deep in my heart, I am aching. I need you now. Like a thief in the night, they come and take all.
You are going to be talking about Arthur Erickson and another fellow.
Jareth Massey, who was the son of the actor Raymond Massey. And my next segment a week from now is going to be on a film Raymond Massey starred in called Things to Come. Have you seen this?
Long time ago.
It's about the future, but they get a lot of it was made in 1936, and they get a lot of things wrong.
Raymond Massey was, of course, the famous actor. This fellow's his son.
Yes.
And there's the other famous Massey, who is Raymond Massey's brother, who was like an important minister in, was it Mackenzie King's government?
Oh, well,
big deal.
You know some information I don't.
I forget his name, though.
I saw it was sort of a talk between the two of them from 2006 with Jareth Massey and Arthur Erickson. And they were talking about how they did SFU. And one thing, it didn't seem like Jareth Massey had any animosity. Like, Arthur Erickson sort of became a bit bigger than him, in a sense. You know, supposedly there's this woman, Lenny Kasdan, who really did the Jane Fonda workout. She was the one who actually did it. And anyway, there's a story behind that. So it's not quite the Jane Fonda workout for the architecture of SFU. Seems that they were happy together. They collaborate to 1972 on a variety of projects. One thing, they won a contest. There was a contest. They had the site here. They did not choose the site of SFU, but there was a contest. And they kind of went away from the original concept, which would have a separate building for each of the departments.
Right, sort of the more traditional university campus sort of arrangement.
But they both had the concept of having it one, well, it's kind of one building, isn't it?
It is kind of like, because everything's attached, right? You know, there are separate buildings, and I put little air quotes up there, but everything's sort of built and connected, so there's a sort of central spine that you can walk along from one part of the campus to another and always be covered and whatnot.
Covered from the rain.
Yeah, and you're not separated by, you know, a grass field or anything like that, and some walkways. It's pretty much all built together.
Even though we have that square, which is the empty area,
the academic quadrangle,
the academic quadrangle.
Yep.
There were some ideas that didn't come through. Like Arthur Erickson speaks of planting a bunch of poppies amongst the grass. That kind of didn't. They just wound up mowing both at the end.
Oops.
now, be honest with me, Magnus. Do you actually like the architecture here or not?
I'm sort of mixed. I mean, I think there's a lot that's interesting about it, and there's definitely some interesting views and whatnot of the building. But it's also, it can be a really gray place because, of course, it's all concrete, which I understand was quite innovative at the time.
Yes, and unfinished.
And unfinished concrete. It's not, you know, concrete construction and then faced with brick or other stuff. It's, you know, it's the raw concrete. So that can sometimes get a little gray because, of course, weather-wise, it often gets quite gray up here too. You know, we're on top of the mountain and up in the clouds, and gray skies, and gray buildings.
Well, Arthur Erickson was always big on, he died, just so he would have been 100 years old if he was still around, but he died about 15 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. And he was big on that concrete and not painting it over. And that was one of his big things.
Yeah, showing the materials.
There's a connection, even though he wasn't, have you ever heard about brutalist art? Architecture.
Yes.
No, yeah. I just heard about this like 6 months ago, but you've heard about this.
Yeah, I'm sort of into architecture a bit. I'm not an expert, though.
And so a brutalist architecture is where they go out of their way to do something not that good.
Often quite harsh because it's like, you know, big masses of concrete, you know, which may not, you know, which you know, so like a solid wall of concrete, kind of big corner, and, you know, not pretty shapes and nice curves, but, you know, sharp angles and massive, heavy appearing, you know, blocks in within the construction.
So Arthur Erickson was the Magentilus of the brutes when drawing it. Even though he never really got classified as that, in Wikipedia, it says that brutalist architecture is an architectural style that emerged in the 1950s in the United Kingdom. Now, the Soviet Union also had it, but it supposedly originated in the United Kingdom.
Interesting, because, you know, the certain amount of German, you know, pre-war and wartime architecture also
That's
had,
the Bauhaus, isn't it?
Well, there's that, but there's also, you know, they had this sort of style of heroic architecture under the Nazis, which I guess it wasn't, you know, officially called brutalist, but it had certainly, you know, some of those tendencies, you know. Again, big, strong architecture, right? Big masses and of building and stuff like that.
One of the intriguing things about Arthur Erickson is where he lived. It was a garage,
mm-hmm.
and the house was torn down, before he bought it, and it had a wild garden, a cultivated wild garden,
mm-hmm.
and he had a big giant fence around. Now I know where it is,
yeah,
but at the time when he was well known, he didn't let. Know the exact address, which you can get by the Arthur Erickson Institute website.
Okay.
But so he could have the privacy, even have a documentary. Here's my place. Could he put kind of this fence around it? So here I live in the garage. I change this garage around. So that was sort of a neat thing.
Yeah.
One thing is interesting. He went to Japan in 1961, and here were some statements he says. Unlike us, the Japanese do not... This is Arthur Erickson talking.
Yep.
Unlike us, the Japanese do not move from era to era historically. They pile one on top of another so that one era is never finished but remains alive and vital. Most Western books about Japanese architecture are conditioned by the Bauhaus way of seeing things. So he's sort of saying that the Japanese... don't have this approach. Oh, we got one style. We got a brand new style now.
Yeah,
and which is interesting. That's perhaps a better way of. I'm not saying that it always kind of works, Arthur Erickson, but I think he's the best of the actual of the post Frank Lloyd Wright architects. In a
right,
way. He could even say he was the best post Lloyd Wright architect. Period. Even the whole world, in a sense, mm-hmm. because. I haven't really traveled the world. I was in Tijuana when I was 9 years old. That was quite a while ago. But I haven't really... I mean, I know the architecture around Vancouver and mm-hmm. so on. But the provincial courthouse, which he did himself architect, yep. Is sort of... maybe that's even a better thing for the Arthur Erickson style.
Right. And that's the one that's downtown on sort of Robson and... Robson, Robson and Howe Streets.
It's actually got my map of Vancouver here. It's actually, this is funny how anyway, doesn't matter. It's somewhere.
Yeah, it's Howe and Robson and across Smythe Street because it goes. That goes right over the street there.
What
right
I was going to say was that when you come at one angle, from my perspective, boy, this is not looking that good. But when you come around the other angle, it looks kind of interesting. And even when the courthouse is not open,
mm-hmm.
You can go up the stairs and you can go up there. And it's kind of interesting how it looks.
Yep.
But it's not like every angle looks great. But but then again, it's only one angle. Mm-hmm. So you got another angle that looks a bit better from it. So he was coming from a divergence of ideas and styles. But also, it's interesting that what he said about that. I think he came more from not, okay, this is the modernist style, more just what could be done architecturally.
Yeah.
And he was always kind of for the preservation of older buildings and so on, too. So that was good. One thing is that these are people outside of Vancouver. Some say that the Marine Building at Burrard and Hastings, mm-hmm. northwest corner, is the best surviving piece of Art Deco architecture in the world. Because a lot of it got torn down.
Yeah, it's a great building. You know, the terracotta work. I don't know if it's actually terracotta, but you know, all the moldings and with carvings and stuff all on the outside, all the decorative stuff on the outside is quite spectacular. And apparently, it's also really good inside. I've only ever been into the front lobby, which is one of those high art spaces.
Well, the lobby is how it was, and for some reason they have the signs of the horoscope on the floor, and but then the rest has been it's contemporary versus the floors. But at least you get that inside mm-hmm. of it. Now, one thing, if you see the 1990s movie Time Cop, the Marine Building is in that, and this was you know how Vancouver they. Come across the world to film stuff.
Yeah.
So the Time Cop they're saying you can't travel back in time to invest all this money in stock market and dump it in 1929.
Yeah.
So they used the Marine Building for a 1929 thing. And it was interesting that it was 1930 when they completed it.
Right.
So anyway. It's kind of I actually met Arthur Erickson. Mm-hmm. Not that well, but incidentally. So he was sort of anyway. But there can be complaints about him.
Yeah, another famous building he did was the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, which is in many ways has a similar vibe to this building. It was done sort of in the same era. You can look that up online. But then his houses are really quite different because, of course, nobody wants to live in a kind of concrete bunker type house. So they're much more, you know, that style of, you know, mid-century architect houses where lots of glass and open sight lines and all the rest of that stuff.
I've only seen the Alberta University in film.
Yeah, I've not been there to see
it. But it looks kind of, because it's just a linear line. So I don't know what it's like to be there. I mean, if you don't like SFU, I don't think you're going to like that place.
Yeah.
But there's a funny Arthur Erickson story because he was like a globetrotter. He was mm-hmm. going around the world. And so, you know, sometimes he took a bit of a nap on the plane and he woke up and he didn't know what part of the world he was in for about 15 minutes. It could have been anywhere. It could have been here in Vancouver. Yeah. Could have been elsewhere. Now, one thing, to be a bit critical of him on some other front, he got involved with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, I think he did a military complex there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He wanted to build buildings, I guess. And he didn't. Maybe he wasn't quite politically correct all the time or something. In fact, Trump Tower is basically his last building.
The one in New York?
No, the one in Vancouver.
Oh.
And the one they had to stop calling Trump because he went bankrupt or something.
Yeah,
it was Georgia. Like
a Trump Hotel for a while now. I forget what it's
called. That is Arthur Erickson.
Yeah, interesting.
And so he had collaborations with him. You know, I don't know. So any last words on this, Magnus? We'll leave it to you to say.
Well, it's he's an interesting architect. He was definitely innovative. You know, judging from my walking around here on this campus, he was a little ahead of his time, at least in the sense that, you know, the techniques they were using here didn't always work out perfectly. In the sense that, there's a lot of places where the water gets into the concrete and then it causes the rebar to rust, which has caused some of the concrete sort of flakes away as the rusting metal expands. And I know that because a lot of what they're doing here when this place was built was again sort of new techniques and innovative, and it didn't always work out perfectly. Quite a lot of maintenance cost in keeping the building up. They actually did it's probably 4 or 5 years ago now, but they spent, it was 4 years where there was construction somewhere on campus all the time, and every time you tried to go from one place to another, there was a new route to get there because parts were blocked off. But they did a complete renovation and remediation of a lot of those kind of, bulging rebar problems, and resealed all that up, and it looks nice now.
Okay. Anyway.
All right. That was Arthur Erickson. A little chat about Arthur Erickson. What are you going to be talking about next week, Peter?
Well, I'm going to talk about the father of the other guy, Jerriff Massey.
Yeah.
Now, he was... starred in a movie that's really strange.
Raymond Massey did. Yeah.
Raymond Massey, 1936... Things to Come. It goes by two titles, Shape of Things to Come or Things to Come.
And, of course, it's a production of a famous novel, right?
No, you know what's in it? It's by the screenplay's H.G. Wells.
Okay.
However, it was based on a short story he had done previously, and it was redone because it starts off in 1936, and the short story was done a few decades previously with the same premise. So what happens is 1936, and they talk about... It's also a British film, by the way.
Yeah.
And so people say, do you think there's going to be... This is 1936. Do you think there's going to be a war? And the guy said, I don't think so. Then they have a war, and it lasts about 40 years to 19... No, it does. Until 1960 or 70. And then everybody's in the actual Stone Age. And Raymond Massey...
From the effects of the war.
And Raymond Massey is one of these flying men.
They have
a big, and they land, and he's got a bit of a space shoot. He said, we're going to rebuild society, and it's going to be a lot better.
All right. Well, let's not give away all our secrets. That's coming up next week on our Monday Speak Up. The Shape of Things to Come, or Things to Come. Sci-fi film from 1936.
Yes.
We'll be back.
Curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.